accession number 19896, reel 3.
General Woodford, reel 3.
Right, are we on again?
Yes.
We were talking about the KGB colonel who was really behind the scenes in Berlin in those days, in the middle 50s. And certainly he'd been there for a very long time and was well known to everybody. He was famous, among other things, for having a passion for whiskey. So whenever he came, we always used to get the very best whiskey out for him, which he could drink in industrial quantities without any apparent effect on him. And he was usually accompanied by similar people who came in from outside, either from Pankow, in where the East German headquarters was, or in some cases from further afield still, I suspect probably from Moscow in some of them. And they really were very recognizable. And I remember one particular pair, who were both of whom struck me as being very sinister, because they both had metal teeth. They'd obviously had all their teeth out and metal teeth put in. The other thing about them that amused me, and I discovered this afterwards, not being a Russian speaker, was that they were enthralled by our interpreter, the official interpreter in the British military government at that time, who was a delightful man, long since gone to his reward, called Michael Vadiev. And he was the son of a senior Russian civil servant from pre-revolutionary times who'd grown up in his early days in the old Raj, the old regime. And then his father had managed to get out just about the time of the revolution in 1917. But anyway, the point about him was that he had a very varied career, spoke a whole string of languages beautifully, including English. But what the old KGB colonels were fascinated by was to hear him speak the old-fashioned, cultivated Russian, which, of course, was almost unknown. And they loved the sound of it, which was quite interesting, a little sidelight. But they were very interesting times, and there was a very talented collection of people in, I thought, at that time in the Foreign Office in Berlin, many of whom had very distinguished careers thereafter, numerous ambassadors amongst them. And, of course, it was also the time of the intelligence community at its height, I suppose, and, we had a lot of those, and a lot of people there who worked, as we used to say, behind the grill, and that alone made it very interesting. To say nothing of all the Germans one met, who had a lot of them extraordinary and fascinating stories to tell.
Behind the grill?
Well, we call it behind the grill because they were the security services and they were in a special area of the building, you know, with special entries and permits and one thing or another. I mean, one of their number was George Blake, whom we all knew quite well and who was very popular socially. Of course, none of us had the faintest idea what he was up to. But I can remember very vividly the night when the tunnel underneath the eastern part of Berlin, down in the American sector, was discovered by the Russians, if you remember that incident. There had been a tunnel which had been dug where they tapped into all the communications. It was a great intelligence coup by the West, actually, but they had tapped into all the landlines for the Russians and the East Germans. And this had been... they'd been listening to anything that mattered for a long, long time. And suddenly the tunnel was discovered. The theory, the ostensible reason for being discovered was supposed to be some roadworks, but in fact what had happened, I didn't know this, of course, no one did until many years later, George Blake had blown the gaff on this. But I remember very well the evening when this was discovered, because my boss was having dinner with the American commandant and a number of visiting firemen from West Germany, from the embassies. And it just so happened that all the management, all the senior management of Berlin, were at one dinner party. So the dinner party was cancelled and they all went into session straight away to try and handle the crisis. But that's what made that period in Berlin so interesting. It was also interesting because on the German side, things were happening. For example, there was a very little known member of the, very new member of the Bundestag, who was just beginning to come to notice, and he excelled himself at the time of the Hungarian uprising when a lot of enraged West Berliners were heading for the Brandenburg Gate, and it looked like big trouble. He spent a whole night mostly on the tail of a British Army Land Rover driven by the Royal Military Police, haranguing the crowds and managing to calm them down and turn them. Made a great reputation doing this overnight, pretty well. And the next thing that happened was that the ruling mayor in Berlin died suddenly and unexpectedly, and this particular chap stood for office and was elected by a very large majority. Well, his name was Willy Brandt, and the rest, as they say, is history. But I mean, one knew him quite well. He was a very interesting man to meet and to talk to in those days, because he alone had a fascinating background, because he'd arrived in Berlin as a member of the Norwegian military mission, to all intents and purposes a Norwegian. Of course, he then revealed the fact that he was actually German. Anyway, they were interesting days.
In what way was George Blake so socially popular?
Well, he was just a very delightful, charming man, and he used to turn up to all the parties, was very well known, used the officers' club, which was a sort of social centre, I suppose, a great deal. Everybody knew him, most people knew him. There were a lot of, as always in those circumstances, a lot of very nice, usually attractive girls who worked for the firm, and you know, it was all part of a very active social scene. That's how he was well known. But no one, as far as I'm aware, unless it's a secret one doesn't know, was aware of what he was up to even then. But it was quite, it made it interesting. The other thing was, of course, that Spandau Jail was still in operation in those days, and we still had, I think it was something like 6 or 7 of the those who were sentenced to long sentences still in Spandau. And the commandants, the Allied commandants, took turn and turn about to go and visit. And so when it was the British turn, one had this extraordinary experience of going, rather like the orderly officer, around the prisoners in the Spandau Jail, which was a four-power, one of the few four-power institutions still operating as such. So you had a great entourage from the other three powers. And you went round and you would see the whichever the prisoner was, it would be sort of number two, who would be Hess, and he was asked, well, number two, have you any complaints or anything you wish to say? And it was Hess, of course, he usually sat in a sort of catatonic state on his bed and didn't move and refused to speak at all. But then you'd get on to somebody like von Schirach, who was full of complaints and voluble, and had to be, they had to keep stopping him talking, because, of course, he spoke fluent English and would frequently correct the interpreters. But all that was extraordinarily interesting. And I particularly remember Speer, and this is not being wise after the event, because even then you were aware, the minute you saw him, that he was an extraordinary man. And he, of course, was quite different from the rest in the sense that he was completely a master of himself. He was a very impressive character. You only had to hear him even talk trivialities to realize that. Of course, as we is all well known now, he spent his time, whatever it was, 20-odd years, I suppose, in Spandau Jail, doing his professional work, you know, town planning and drawing up architects' plans and also writing his memoirs. And once I was always very interested to see him being interviewed on television in more recent years before he died. And hearing people like Gitte Sereni talk about him, because having seen him in those early days, you can see what an impressive chap he was. It made the whole thing very interesting.
Now, later you returned to Kenya. Was that during the Mau Mau period?
It was just towards the end of it, but I mean, it was really, technically, the emergency was still on, but in practice it had long since over. I mean, the military phase of the Mau Mau, as you know, finished very early on. I think it was mostly over by late 53, early 54. Although there were still very remote areas where there were active Mau Mau in the forest, but they were mostly remnants from the earlier days. But it was still technically a state of emergency, so there were certain restrictions in certain parts of the country. But we were there, part of the battalion was there for about, altogether about 6 months.
Was there any sense of disturbance or unease whilst you were
no,
there?
No, quite the contrary. It looked as if things had settled down and returned pretty much to normal. And I have to admit, and maybe this was very unperceptive, that it didn't cross my mind, and it didn't, I never heard it discussed, that within a few years, Kenya would become independent. But of course, that's what happened only about 6, 7 years later.
Well, you were there in about 58, I think.
That's right.
So
yes.
Maybe it was even sooner than that.
Well, it was 63, wasn't it? 63-4 was where, I think it was December 63, to be exact, when the independence actually came about. It was clearly in train at that time, and Her Majesty's government at the time were obviously making plans pretty rapidly to do it. but it certainly wasn't the talk of the town.
Did any of the white population in Kenya tell you about their experiences in the emergency?
Naturally, and of course I knew quite a few of them, and in particular I knew a family who lived quite near where we were stationed. We were in a place called Gilgil, which is up the Rift Valley, but a little more than halfway between Nairobi and Nakuru. And nearby, in a farm, halfway up a place called the Kinnenkop, in a place called Kipipiri, there was a family I knew there, and they'd had a very interesting and adventurous time. They were right in the heart of the Mau Mau country. In fact, their particular farm came to no harm at all, and the reason for it they discovered at the end of the emergency, effectively, was that they had a little cell of Mau Mau living on the farm. It wasn't in their interest to be discovered, and that's why they had no trouble. But, of course, there were others nearby who were less lucky.
Do you remember their name?
I could. I'd have to dig it out. I can't bring it to mind at the moment.
Never mind. And then, a bit afterwards, in Cyprus, was that during the Eyoka period?
Well, again, not really, technically. Although, I mean, like the first time I went to Cyprus, which again was in the late 50s, turn of the 60s, the situation was still not quite in a state of emergency, but there was still quite a lot of Eyoka activity going on. But the worst of it by that time was over. And again, the Treaty of Establishment was imminent. In fact, I think it was actually drawn up in 1960-61. But when I first went there, which was, I think, in 59, it was still the sort of tail end of it all. And there was still a certain atmosphere, but what you might call the real shooting war was pretty well over. That was fairly short-lived in any case, as you know.
I think you later returned to Cyprus in a different capacity in the 70s.
Yes, I mean, I went to Cyprus as a visitor in the middle 60s, just after the the first time there was the major clash in 64, if you remember, in the original Green Line in Nicosia. And I went with my boss at that time, who I was working for, when there had been that major clash and the Green Line had been drawn up. And this was only a few days after the events that had caused that. There were still sort of bodies lying in the street, so it was all a bit dramatic. But when I then went back again a few years later, at the end of 72, at the very end of 72, when I handed over my battalion after being in Northern Ireland, and I went back to Cyprus then as the, I suppose you'd call me the Army Chief of Staff, but also in the Joint Headquarters there. And we spent most of 73 in a fairly routine way, but aware that there were a lot of troubles brewing, because there was a great deal of activity with Eyoka B, as it was then called, and a lot of very troublous events happening in Cyprus itself, although they didn't much affect the sovereign base areas. I don't think anybody at that time really thought that there was going to be not exactly a revolution, but events would be on quite the scale they later turned out to be. But we all knew something was going to happen. And sure enough, it did, of course, in mid-74.
Can you tell me what you personally experienced of that?
Well, we were there throughout, I suppose, in the sovereign base areas, but who weren't directly in the firing line, although we did have our adventures. But what happened was, in the middle of July 1974, an attempt was made to unseat Makarios, the president, and indeed an attempt was made to kill him, and luckily he got away, luckily for him that is, he got away and managed somehow, with the help of his chaplain, I think a couple of his chaplains, to make an escape up into the Troodos and then down to Paphos, where he took refuge with the Bishop of Paphos, and eventually he was evacuated by the Brits, by an RAF helicopter, although I remember vividly at the time, because I was part of the system that arranged it, we had first of all to find out where he was, and secondly to make certain that it was him and not somebody else, all of which I arranged with various people, slightly under the counter, because it really had to be done by the UN, which we weren't supposed to have direct dealings with. And one of the conditions made by HMG at the time was that the helicopter that brought him out of Paphos to get him to Akrotiri, the RAF main base, and from there by RAF aeroplane back to England, that the helicopter itself had to show no markings of any kind which could identify it, as if that was going to fool anybody. but they wasn't even allowed to wear UN markings. So they had to go in absolutely anonymously with no signs of any kind, which was an absurdity, but still that's what happened. Anyway, he was evacuated. And as I recall, via Malta, he then spent the next few months in England until he was brought back when the war had died down at the end of the year. But in the meantime, of course, the coup by Nikos Samson, who was a well-known Iroko hood from the earlier times, took place. And, of course, immediately the Greek-Turkish civil war, which I think it was really, started all over again with atrocities in various directions on both sides, culminating in the Turkish invasion, which took place quite soon afterwards.
Did the Samson coup take you by surprise?
Yes. Yes, I don't think any of us, certainly not the intelligence community in Cyprus at that time, anticipated it would be anything like on that scale. We were well aware of Aoka B and the difficulties they were having, and there was trouble between the bishops, as there always was, and all kinds of Byzantine goings on, but no one forecast that it would be quite on that scale. And you may remember that in the earlier period, in the middle 60s, the Turks had actually launched an invasion force and were only turned back at the last minute. Well, this time the same thing happened, but of course this time they actually did land. And it was a very interesting and also a very harrowing time.
In what way harrowing?
Well, harrowing because, the casualties of war. The British in the sovereign base areas, by and large, got away with it pretty well, although we had our casualties too during the period of the emergency. But a lot of British nationals, particularly those who lived up in the north and around Kyrenia, lost a great deal. And they had a very adventurous times because it was a pretty major event. Naval gunfire, for example, straight onto the Kyrenia and all its surrounds, and particularly into the pass that went down to Nicosia, the road that went through the mountains there. And then, of course, there was a large airborne drop, if you remember, by the Turkish army, just on the north side of Nicosia. And then there was a brief period of, we'll hardly call it stability, but anyway, there was a brief sort of pause while negotiations were attempted, and then came phase two, when the Turks broke out and headed eastwards and took Famagusta. And it eventually settled down on the line that it now is and has been since 1974. And that line remains, with northern Cyprus in Turkish hands and the south in Greek hands.
What was the attitude of Greek and Turkish Cypriots toward you and British personnel at that time?
Well, in a sense, they were too preoccupied with each other to worry too much about us. But the sovereign base areas actually did become places of refuge. I mean, overnight, I can't remember the figures now, but I think it was something like 4,000 Turkish Cypriots, suddenly literally appeared at the Episcopi end, into what was called Happy Valley, which were a series of really sports grounds, an area which was entirely devoted to sort of parkland and sports grounds mainly. And all these Turks just came flooding in from the surrounding villages, having been attacked. And many of them were wounded. There were sort of women giving birth and all kinds of dramas, and we had to cope with that. Usually, as ever, the sappers in particular were heavily committed, doing all the things that the sappers do so well, but we had to produce these great refugee camps. And the same thing happened at the other end of the island in the Decalia sovereign base area a little later on, when at phase two, when the Turks invaded and captured Famagusta, and in particular captured Varosha, which was the Greek southern end of Famagusta. And another great influx of refugees, this time mainly Greeks, came into the Decalia sovereign base area. And again, we had overnight to produce refugee camps and look after them. And there those camps were for weeks and months and months and months until they were eventually repatriated much later, months and months afterwards. Though they were certainly stirring times. And we also had a major evacuation problem because we evacuated all the UN and their families out of Nicosia, brought them back down into the sovereign base areas, and in many cases then moved them on back to England or wherever. In the meantime, of course, Nicosia Airport had been written off. It was the only other airport in the island at that time. So Akrotiri, the RAF base, was the only place that had an airfield. And the only aircraft that came in and out were military. And the RAF, in the end, ran an evacuation program, a sort of airlift of refugees. I've forgotten again the figures, but they were certainly well over, there were tens of thousands, I think it was about 50,000 in the end was the total, that were actually got out of the island, of all shapes, sizes, sorts, and nationalities. It was a fairly major event. I think it was the biggest deployment of troops overseas since Suez at that time. Of course, there have been sizable ones since, and notably the Gulf War, but I think that was the biggest up to that time.
What was your job at the time?
I was the Army Chief of Staff, and really, I suppose you would say, the Operations Chief of Staff in the Sovereign Base areas, acting for, first of all, my immediate boss, who was the general out there, and his immediate boss, who was a three-star joint service commander, who was an airman.
What were the main problems that you had during the crisis?
Well, they were mainly to do with the security of the base areas themselves and doing what we could to help the United Nations and support them. And we weren't allowed to do this directly because, of course, they were under UN command, to help them and also to cope with the refugee problems and, as I say, looking after the security of the sovereign base areas, not least our facilities in the east, which were so important strategically.
Can we say something about Northern Ireland? Because I think you had two main spells in Northern Ireland.
Yes, I commanded my battalion there for the best part of a year in the early years, in that really, really difficult time, late 71 to late 72. And then I went back after the Cyprus crisis to command a brigade, which I had the 3 Brigade, which was the one that did, 4 out of the 6 counties. It was all the South Armagh and border area.
Can we talk about each in turn? First of all, 70-72, when you were with the 3rd Royal Regiment of Fusiliers?
Yes, this is the 3rd Battalion. We formed a large regiment in 68, and by this time my old battalion was the 3rd Royal Regiment of Fusiliers. Strictly speaking, it wasn't exactly like that, but near enough. And I took command of that in Gibraltar in 1970, and was there for a short time, and then we came back to England, and from there went straight on our first tour to Northern Ireland, supposedly for a 4-month tour, which turned in the end into a 10-month tour.
What was the situation like when you got there?
Well, chaotic, to be honest. I mean, I can be a little bit blunt now, but I mean, I thought the whole system when we first arrived was left a great deal to be desired. First of all, the preparation for tours in Northern Ireland in those days was amateurish to a degree. It was almost impossible to get hold of any kind of kit, let alone the sort of kit and equipment. Specialist equipment, particularly on the scale that has become familiar since. But what used to be called, for example, sniper scopes, that's to say, equipment that you could use at night with weapons, there were very few of them. And I can remember having to go on my knees to some friend or other and try and borrow a few so that at least some of my soldiers that had some experience of them knew how to use them. But there was no system. Later on, fairly soon afterwards, an extremely sophisticated and very well-run system of preparation for Northern Ireland came about, with the magnificent facilities down at what had been, in the good old days, part of the School of Infantry, down at Hythe in Kent. But this was long before that, and when I first went, as I say, it was all pretty primitive. Furthermore, the management at that time, the military management, for reasons I never fully understood, tended to split battalions up and take a company to go over here and another company to go somewhere else. And they did it to everybody. So you finished up in the end with a kind of mixed bag with your own battalion scattered all over the province. And various units from other, various subunits from other battalions under your command. And the logic of all that rather escaped me at the time. The logistics weren't much better. Most of the bases were primitive to a degree. So all that wasn't too clever, I didn't think. But it was certainly very interesting. And of course, these were the hot times. This was the end of the internment troubles, when they, you remember the internment that took place in late 71. We weren't involved in that directly, but we got the aftermath of that. And then we then began, before long, we then started on the large civil rights marches of the time, most notably, of course, Bloody Sunday, which we were involved in, to the extent that we were in Londonderry at the time, and be with the next battalion in after one para, had that been necessary? As in the event, of course, it wasn't.
What did you see at that time?
What, a Bloody Sunday, do you mean?
Yes.
Well, I saw a fair bit, quite a lot of the prologue to it, if you can call it that, with the usual junketings that went on in William Street from Waterloo Car Park before one para were deployed. And I witnessed that going in, and of course, because I was next in according to the plan, I was actually listening out on one para radio. So what I couldn't see, I could listen to, or listen to quite a lot of it.
What were these junketings in
William Street? William Street was famous, or infamous, I'd rather call it, for what used to be I used to call a sort of regular afternoon sort of gavotte, where all the hoods would come rushing down William Street and hurl stones and petrol bombs and everything else at a lot of fairly resigned troops at the other end, the Waterloo Car Park end, who would take refuge behind their armoured vehicles, their pigs, and their put on their helmets and have their shields out. And they would respond in various ways, usually by firing baton rounds. And this exchange would go on for an hour or two until somebody got fed up or got tired and they'd pack up and go home. And this seemed to happen day after day after day, mostly in the afternoon. It became almost a sort of form of entertainment, as far as I could see. On Bloody Sunday, of course, it was a little bit different because there was this major march of several thousand, which was planned and was known to be walking down through the bogside. And so I think probably the temperature had been raised deliberately anyway with that event in prospect. So that's what I meant by the junketings down William Street.
How was the temperature raised?
Well, simply by a much more active and much more intensive barrage of missiles, petrol bombs and the like down William Street.
How did the troops stand up to all this?
Extremely well, with great stoicism. As I say, they usually used to be sort of fairly resigned to the chores it always became of going down to William Street in the afternoon and coping with this, because those were those unhappy days when the bogside was a no-go area. In other words, we weren't allowed into it. It should never have been allowed, in my view. It was a disgrace that it was ever allowed for as long as it did happen. But it meant, really, that we could not deploy people into the bogside, let alone the Cregan, to deal with these hoods, who really had a free run. And they had this great legend, which you will have seen. I think they still preserved it. You know, you are now entering Free Derry, it was called, and I'm afraid that was true. The only way you could do anything about it was to look at them from the city walls or from OPs in various places, which of course was done.
Did you come into contact with the IRA themselves?
Oh, sure.
In what way?
Well, I mean, we were operating against them. We were operating against them all over the province. I mean, I had a company in Londonderry, attached to another unit there. I had a company in West Belfast, attached to another unit there. Then I had the balance of my battalion in Mid Tyrone, with detachments off in South Armagh and scattered all over the place. As I say, when they used to fracture every battalion. I mean, I had a company of the Devon and Dorsets. So I had a Marine commando from a company. I had some Lancers, as I recall, a troop of Lancers. A great sort of mixed bag of people. It was all quite fun, I suppose, but the logic of it, as I say, escaped me. But we'd been operating against the IRA from the time we got in there. In the usual way, patrols, a lot of them on the border, of course. And we had got a good many contacts too, particularly in South Armagh. But also, the usual business went on. I mean, Londonderry was absurd. There was a place called Bly's Lane, or as the locals called it, Blee's Lane, with an old shirt factory. And this became a little sort of outpost in the middle of a no-go area. And to get to it, to man it, the purpose of manning was never entirely clear to me, you had to go in an armoured vehicle, and as you did, you were sniped at in broad daylight. Which, I mean, is a disgraceful performance, really, when you think about it.
What success did you have against the IRA?
Well, we like to think we had quite a lot. I mean, the detail I can't now recall, but we certainly had our successes, as most units did. They had to be worked very hard for, because...